Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on cross-examination when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of this alleged crime, and what you should say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, and conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements, 28 things that you need to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. And rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent's ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything. And then shut up. And after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, the school, is available on compact disc for home education. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Let's take a look at expert witnesses. An expert witness is a hired gun. He's a paid professional liar. Let me repeat that in case you missed it. A hired gun. Expert witness. An expert witness is a paid professional liar. He gets $600 a day to come into court and tell lies. He's a partisan. He's there working for his side. And it doesn't make any difference to him whose side he's on. And that's because he's a paid professional. And he's hired to come into court to testify. He's hired to come into court and testify in your case. He doesn't know anything about your case. He doesn't know anything about the facts. He wasn't there when the accident occurred. These experts are necessary and imperative because many times an expert gives information that we need to arrive at a conclusion. Not everything that a witness says is a lie. Oftentimes, a witness will tell the truth, and he'll tell nothing but the truth. I mean, this guy is so honest and so truthful that he just laying out the facts, the science is there, but he doesn't tell you all of the truth. He doesn't tell you the other side of the story. He doesn't tell you what he doesn't want you to hear. And this leads you to a wrong conclusion, sitting there as a juror, as a fact finder, as a judge. Now, judges are paid, professional, truth seekers. That's the judge's job. His job is to sort through all of the lies that are coming through all of the witnesses in all of the testimony. Now, remember, all of the witnesses are lying 25% of the time, even if they intend to tell the truth. So a witness's job is to just tell what he knows in the form of, what do you know, what did you hear, what did you see? What do you see, what do you know, what do you hear? And a witness should answer the questions, yes, no, and I don't know. Yes, no, and I don't know. Yes, no, and I don't know. And anything more than that should be applied to the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid. Keep it simple, stupid. Keep it simple, stupid. When you're asked a question, and the question requires a narrative answer, what did you see the defendant do after he got out of the car? Well, just tell what you saw him do. He jumped up and down three times, picked up his attaché case, and walked into the house. Right? That keeps the answer simple. I watch the McNeil Lair News Hour typically every night, and I'm always amazed at the testimony that comes from the witnesses that are brought in to testify to certain facts. And so the investigator, in this case the journalist, you know, it may be Margaret or it may be Lair, they'll ask a question. And this guy goes on and he talks and he talks and he talks and he talks and then he talks some more. Good thing they don't have me on their hour. He'd ask me a question and I'd answer it yes, no, and I don't know. That'd be the last time they ever had me on there. Because see, they've got to fill up one whole hour of time. I'm a broadcaster. I know what it is to fill up one whole hour. I've got to be talking the whole time for one whole hour. I know what they're up to. They're filling up the space. They're not disseminating any critical information. The guy could answer the question half the time, yes, no, I don't know. Yes, no, I don't know. But he launches into a long tirade and he talks and he talks and he talks. He doesn't say anything, but he talks a lot. And it fills up time. And after all, that's what the news hour is all about. Filling up time and keeping you entertained. That's what the news is all about. It's entertainment interspersed with commercials. The real purpose for a news broadcast is to sell Mercuries and Fords and Chevrolets. That's the purpose for the news. But in order to keep you focused on buying Chevrolets and Fords and Mercuries, we have to entertain you in the space between the commercials where we're selling you automobiles. That's what the bottom line is. Now remember this, if you're a witness, you get on the witness stand and you tell what you know, what you heard, and what you saw. And you say, yes, no, and I don't know. Yes, no, and I don't know. When you're asked for a narrative answer, you pause, take a breath, answer the question in as few words as possible. Kind of like God saying, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. God can say more in four words than the Congress of the United States can say in four books. So concentrate on that and see if you can help the judge and the fact finder sitting in the jury box by answering the questions and tell us what you know, what you heard, and what you saw. Now, there's another factor that comes in here. I've alluded to this now in the last couple of broadcasts. I said it's called the Kwok-Ting test. So I told you, number one, testimony must be complete. And then I told you, number two, the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. I told you about little Georgie Gordon and the fish story. Extemporaneous detail. If you were to ask me where Corbell, California was, I should be able to tell you it's in Humboldt County. The third item in the Kwok-Ting test is that the testimony that you give has to be supported by witnesses and or evidence. You know, a photograph of those 237 fish in a pile sitting on the kitchen sink or on the kitchen counter would be conclusive evidence that, well, there's the 237 fish. And little Georgie Gordon said he caught him. Now, a picture of little Georgie Gordon at about age 5 with those 237 fish sitting on the kitchen counter would be even better evidence than a picture of the fish by themselves, now, wouldn't it? Now, if this picture is an old, faded picture that's many, many years old, obviously, by the yellowing of the back of the picture. Maybe a date on it that said August the 22nd, 1945, along with the physical likeness of little kid here. See this little kid and this pile of fish on the counter? That would be even better evidence, wouldn't it? So not only does it require my extemporaneous statements and corroborative statements, like where is Corbell, California, and who was your first grade teacher, and who was the principal of the school, and. But in addition to that, you have some physical, tangible evidence to go along with it, like a picture would be just honky-dory, or corroboration. Maybe Ronnie Mitchell could come in and testify and say, yes, the story that George just told you is essentially true. Let me add a little something to it, I don't think that Georgie had the whole story straight. And he might add or detract from it. Now remember, the judge is a professional fact finder. The judge knows this test. He knows the Kwok Ting test. He knows that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth isn't true. But he doesn't tell you that. You're not supposed to know that. Lawyers know that. Judges know that. But you're not supposed to know that. You see, if everybody knew the answers to Friday's test, everybody would ace the test. So in order for us to actually find out what you know, we have to know, but you're not supposed to know, so we're going to inquire of you. And that's why we have contradictions. I know because I talked. I've talked to other witnesses. Now I bring you in and I sit you down and we're going to ask you some questions. And this is why excluding witnesses from the courtroom is so important. We don't want the witnesses to all hear what each other witness is telling so that he can back up his story. We put all those witnesses out in the hall. That's the purpose for that. And we bring them in one at a time and we put them on the witness stand and we start asking them questions for the express purpose. If they're telling the truth, they'll all answer the same way. If they're lying, they'll be all over the map. And after all, that's the purpose for cross-examination, is to find out who's telling the truth and who isn't. And always bear in mind, just because somebody's lying doesn't mean that he's doing it with malice. My God, he may actually believe the lie that he's telling. The woman who points her finger at the defendant and says, that's the man that raped me, she's not lying deliberately. Honest to God, she believes that that's the guy that raped her. The real test is to find out, well, why do you believe that, lady? What convinced you that I'm the one that raped you? Was it the policeman who, through the power of suggestion, cunningly coerced you into identifying me in the lineup? You know, oftentimes people are convinced and persuaded of things that aren't true, like the war in Iraq. I mean, we were all persuaded that there were weapons of mass destruction. We all knew Saddam Hussein was a jerk, didn't we? It didn't take very much for George Bush to convince me that he had nuclear weapons, or that he was trying to get nuclear weapons, or that he had gas and he had bacterial weapons. I didn't stretch my imagination when he told me that. But you know, 2 years later, we find out that no, that didn't happen. That wasn't true. And then it gets worse than that. Now we're finding out that Bush and Blair had meetings and that they were planning on concocting a story to get the war in Iraq going so that we, that's you and I, would believe it. Now that's lying. That's called actual fraud. That's lying with malice. That's with intent. And that's what we're coming up to here. Remember, fraud takes two forms. It's actual fraud. That's where I'm lying to you and I know I'm lying to you and I'm doing it deliberately and I got a motive for lying to you. I want to deceive you. And then there's constructive fraud. That's where I'm lying to you, but I actually believe my own lie. I actually believe what I'm telling you is the truth. Now, Colin Powell, remember, I used him as an example the other day, came into the United Nations and he presented a hell of a story proving that Saddam Hussein had these weapons of mass destruction and that this guy was a kook and a madman and that he needed to be stopped and blah, blah, blah. Colin Powell lied to us. But honest to God, I think he believed the lie that he was telling. I mean, it was a convincing story. I mean, he was serious. And he produced photographs and intelligence reports and all kinds of neat stuff. Remember that? All right, well, the same thing happens down here at the lower level. Policeman comes in and he lies about you, and you're sitting on the, you know, at the defense table, and this cop is up on the witness stand. He's lying to you. I've had that happen to me more than once. And it just frosts you when this guy is sitting up there telling these lies about you. And in the early days when I was first starting in law, it really got me and it just ticked me off. Today I look at the poor jerk and I say to myself, God, I wonder if he actually believes his own story. Sounds like President Johnson actually believes the BS that he's telling us. Now there's a difference between lying with malice and intent and lying out of ignorance. So let's understand that. And the judge's job is to filter through all these lies, and the judge cannot let the jury know that he knows that this witness is lying. See? Jurors are just average Joe Sixpacks like you and I. They've never heard of the Kwok Ting test. They don't know. So let me tell you what this Kwok Ting test is all about. This kid is 16 years old and he's a Chinaman. And he's here in the United States, and he's picked up by the Immigration Service, and they're going to deport him back to China. So he says, through his interpreter, he says, no, I was born here in San Francisco. I was born here. And because I was born here and I lived here until I was 8 years old, I'm a citizen of the United States. And then my mama took me back to China. And I've been in China for 8 years, but now I wanted to come back to the United States, so I came back to the United States and I'm a citizen. Well, now, who can contradict his testimony? So this case winds its way through the judicial process. It ends up on the desk of the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, this case is called Kwok Ting versus United States, and it's dated May 11, 1891. Chinese citizenship is the subject matter. Is this guy a citizen of China or a citizen of the United States? If he was born here in the United States, well, then he's a citizen of the United States. But he said he was born here. The Immigration Service says, no, he wasn't born here. He was born in China, and maybe he's been here, maybe he hasn't, but he wasn't born here in the United States. So this guy, Kwok Ting, he says, no, I lived here in the United States till I was 8 years old, and I was taken back to China by my mama when I was 8 years old. Now, Let's test this for a minute and let's see. Can you remember when you were 8 years old? I can. I can remember many events that transpired when I was 8 years old. I was in the third grade and my third grade teacher was Mrs. Wiles. And the K Street car was the car that came by our house. At the time I lived in Los Angeles, California. Now, I can remember that much. I remember our school's name was the West Vermont School. My teacher was Mrs. Wilds. I can't remember the principal. I can remember some of the kids that went there. There was Bobby. There was Frederick. And Betty Budinsky. I remember the teacher had a girl by the name of Betty, and she butted in a lot, and she was a very excited girl, and she always interrupted people, you know. She had to get the answer out to show everybody how smart she was. Well, anyway, Mrs. Wiles created what she called the Budinsky Club and made Betty the chairman of the Budinsky Club, and we all called her Betty Budinsky. Betty Budinsky was her name. I don't know what her real last name was, but now I can remember some little things like that occurred when I was 8 years old. And we would presume that you could too. So in the case, they asked questions of Kwok Ting. They said, well, where did you live in San Francisco? Well, he couldn't remember. What was your address? Well, he couldn't remember. What was the name of your school? Well, he didn't know. And what was your teacher's name? Well, he didn't know that either. When they asked him about, you know, 10 or 15 extemporaneous questions about things that an 8-year-old kid should know about the time when he was 8 years old, he couldn't answer a single question. Not a one. So the Supreme Court came back and they said, this guy's lying. He wasn't born in San Francisco. He didn't live in San Francisco. He didn't know anything about San Francisco. 8 years ago any more than he knew about San Francisco today. In other words, the guy was obviously lying. And that's because he couldn't tell a complete story. He could not give extemporaneous details, and he did not have a single witness or any evidence to support his extemporaneous detail of his complete story. He fell down on all three tests. All right, now the three tests are, when you've got a story, your story must be complete. Second, the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. Anytime that the cross-examiner asks you some little detail, you have to give him an answer. And if you can't give him an answer, that doesn't help you. Now, you don't have to remember everything, but you got to remember something. You can't be 8 years old, and I've tested this in my own classroom here, you know. I'll take this test, and I'll say, well, let me ask you a question. You were 8 years old one time. What was the name of your teacher? Some students here in the class will say, I can't remember my teacher, but my school's name was, and they can tell you the name of their school, the Lincoln School, the Marshall School, the Eureka High School. They can tell you the name of a principal or some of the children who went to school there. They can identify the letter of the streetcar that went by, or the bus line, or the name of the cab company in your town. You know, the City Cab Company, the California Cab Company, the Yellow Cab Company, the Checker Cab Company. You know, there's something about this event. There's something about your childhood. There's something about this period of time that you can remember and relate to us. And then, is there anybody else that can come in and testify to these facts? So some person, some picture, some photograph, some document, a report card, something, anything. What have you got? Now, if you come in here and you say, well, I don't have a report card and I have no supporting evidence, I don't have any other witnesses, and I don't know the whole story, you might as well sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and let us get on with the proceedings, because you're not going anywhere. That's the bottom line. All right, now with that out of the way, let's take a look at the case where a guy comes in here as an expert witness. And my purpose here now is to show you that expert witnesses are paid professional liars. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't hire one. I mean, there's times if your opponent calls an expert witness, you're going to have to call an expert witness. In other words, if he's going to call a liar in here to lie about you, you got to call a liar in to tell the truth about you. That's all. Now, an example of lying expert witnesses is where some guy murders somebody, and then his defense team hires a psychiatrist who comes in and testifies that this guy is as crazy as a cut coon. Just absolutely bonkers. Then the state comes in with a psychiatrist and he says, well, I examined this guy and he's just as straight and level and as sane as you and I. Both of these psychiatrists are licensed by the state. They've both been to college. They're both trained expert professionals. One says he's crazy, the other guy says he's sane. Well, they both can't be right. So one of them's lying. Maybe both of them are lying. But at least one of them is. So from our point of view, I don't care what this guy is coming in to testify about. One side is going to get a paid professional lying expert witness to testify in his side of the case that makes his side of the case look like that's true. And then the other side's going to come in with an expert witness who's going to contradict the other expert witness. You can have engineers. One engineer says, yes, this bridge was built in workmanlike condition, and I looked at the plans, and that bridge was perfect in every way. And then the other one comes in there and says, no, that bridge was poorly constructed and it was poorly engineered, and no wonder the damn thing fell down. And so you and I, as lay people, we sit over here and we don't know which one of these liars to believe. And that's the purpose. You see, if one guy brings in his expert witness and he testifies that that bridge was perfect, and you don't bring in an expert witness to say that, no, that bridge was really stupid design, the jury's going to believe the expert. But when you bring in two experts and one says he's crazy and the other guy says that he isn't, it's like he said, she said. He said, she said. He said, she said. We don't know what the hell to believe, so we throw the testimony of both of them out. We just cancel them out. And oftentimes that's a necessity in a case. You have to cancel that guy out. He doesn't hurt you because we got a paid liar over here, and he canceled out your paid liar. So the two paid liars are out of the game. Now we can get on with the rest of the case. I had a judge tell me one time, he said, you don't need expert witnesses at all. No point in having an expert witness come into the courtroom. Because the witness for the prosecution is going to say one thing, and the witness for the defense is going to say exactly the opposite. Every time. He said, I've been sitting on the bench here for 13 years, never seen an example of it, where two experts ever came in and agreed. I mean, if the experts agreed, you wouldn't need any experts at all, would you? Now, here's a case of an expert witness. Now, occasionally, when sufficient knowledge of facts about the witness or about the details of the direct testimony can be correctly anticipated, a trap may be set into which even a clever witness, as in the illustration that follows, will be likely to fall. Now, the reason we bring this up is because there are times when you can get an expert witness on the witness stand and eat his lunch. And this is an example of one of those times when ordinarily you can't catch an expert witness in his own lies because he's an expert. I mean, this guy's not only an expert in his field, he's an expert liar. This guy is a professional witness. This guy comes in here and lies all the time. He's like a policeman. Policemen come into court and testify every day of the week. It's their job. How often do you come in and testify against a policeman? Maybe once or twice in your lifetime. That's no contest. Now, during the lifetime of Dr. J.W. Rainey, there were few physicians in this country who were so frequently seen on the witness stand as Rainey, especially in damage suits. So expert a witness had Rainey become that Chief Justice Van Brunt many years ago told me that any lawyer who attempts to cross-examine Dr. Rainey is a fool, unquote. Well, a case occurred in my practice a few years before Dr. Rainey died, where a failure to cross-examine Rainey would have been tantamount to a confession of judgment. And though fully aware of the dangers, I didn't have any other alternative. And as so often happens, where fools rush in, I made one of those lucky bullseyes that is perhaps worth recording. So here it is. It was a damage case brought against the city of New York by a lady who, on her way from church one spring morning, had tripped over an obscure encumbrance in the street and had, in consequence, been practically bedridden for 3 years leading up to the day of trial. She was brought into the courtroom in a chair. She was placed in front of the jury. She was a pallid, pitiable object, surrounded by her woman friends, who acted upon this occasion as nurses, constantly bathing her hands and her face with ill-smelling ointments and administering restoratives with very marked effect upon the jury. Her counsel was ex-Chief Justice Noah Davis, and claimed that her spine had been permanently injured and asked the jury for $50,000 in damages. It appeared that Dr. Rainey had been in constant attendance upon the patient ever since the day of her accident. He testified that he had visited her some 300 times, and that he had examined her minutely at least 200 times. In order to make up his mind as to the absolutely correct diagnosis of her case, which he was now thoroughly satisfied was one of genuine disease of the spinal marrow itself. Let me pause right here, boys and girls. Now, Dr. Rainey has testified that he has visited with, and that he has looked at this patient 300 times over 3 years. Now, 3 times 365 times 3 is 1,095. Now, we're going to presume that Dr. Rainey operates his clinic 6 days a week and takes 52 days off. So let's take off minus 156. We have your 1095. Take away 156, and doesn't that leave 939? Now, let's divide that by 3. Now, that means that if he looked at her 300 times out of 900 days, he had to see her once every 3 days. Does that sound logical to you? Do you believe that a doctor is going to visit with a patient over a course of 3 years once every 3 days? Now, right away, that ought to send a signal to you that, hey, that guy ain't telling the truth. At least he's not telling the truth about that particular fact. Now, if he's not telling the truth about that particular fact, at least it raises a suspicion in my mind. It may be an exaggeration. Now, I've been injured a time or two, and I've known some people that have been injured a time or two. Even Vietnam or Iraqi veterans that have had their legs blown off and have been severely injured do not visit their doctor every 3 days. Now, this woman is severely injured, but I find it hard to believe that this doctor visited this woman every 3 days. So when you see something like that, it sends you a signal that says, here's a red flag that needs to be investigated. Hang on, we'll be back with more of the investigation on Dr. Rainey, the expert witness, when we come back. Okay, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, history, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Remember, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book called The Art of Cross-Examination. It happens to be one of the lessons that I teach in courtroom strategy and procedure. The purpose for the program is to show you that there is hope when you are a criminal defendant and you are innocent and people are lying about you. We can uncover those lies and we can prove that you're innocent. But it does take some skill, ability, and know-how. It doesn't happen accidentally. 94% of criminal defendants are convicted. Only 85% should be convicted. 85% are guilty. 15% are not. And the 6% that aren't convicted aren't necessarily innocent. You know, juries cut 6% of them loose. So we'll assume that 6% of the 85% are actually guilty, but they're cut loose by the jury, and 15% go to jail and they're actually innocent. We know that in rape cases. We know that 30% of rape convictions are bogus. Now, oftentimes, a conviction comes based upon the lying testimony of an expert witness. So when we have an expert witness on the stand, there are some strategies that we can use to impeach his testimony once we find out, either from his past performance, or maybe his past history, maybe from a deposition, maybe it's from police reports, maybe it's from his statements that he has made that we've received on discovery. We analyze those and we find out, is this guy telling the truth or is this guy lying? And already, he has said, I visited this woman 300 times in 3 years, that's once every 3 days in a 6-day work week. Right away, my red flag went up. I said, I don't believe that. And if he's lying about the number of times that he visits the patient, could he be lying about something else? Now, let's understand something. Nobody lies 100% of the time. So Dr. Rainey is telling the truth 75% of the time. It's just 25% of the time that he's lying. But is that 25% of his lies going to tip this case against you and in favor of your opponent? Let's see. Well, it was a damage case brought against the city. Remember, this lady over here is seeking $50,000 damages. That's a lot of money in 1888. Probably $5 million in today's dollars. And it appeared that Dr. Rainey had been in constant attendance upon this patient ever since the day of her accident. He testified that he had visited her home 300 times and examined her minutely at least 200 times in order to make up his mind as to the absolute correct diagnosis of her case. Now, Judge Davis asked him a few preliminary questions and then gave the doctor his head and bade him turn to the jury and tell him all about it. Well, Dr. Rainey spoke uninterruptedly for nearly 3/4 of an hour, and he described in detail the sufferings of his patient since she had been under his care, his efforts to relieve her pain, the hopeless nature of her malady. He then proceeded in a most impressive way to picture to the jury the gradual and the relentless progress of the disease as it assumed the form of creeping paralysis involving the destruction of one organ after another until death became a blessed relief. At the close of this recital, without a question more, Judge Davis turned to me and he said in a calm but triumphant tone, "Do you wish to cross-examine?" Now, the one point that was in dispute, there was no defense on the merits, and that was the nature of this patient's malady. The city's medical witnesses were unanimous that this lady had not and could not have contracted spinal disease from the slight injury that she had received. They styled her complaint as hysterical, existing in the patient's mind alone, and not indicating nor involving a single diseased organ. But the jury evidently all believed Dr. Rainey, and they were very anxious to render a verdict on his testimony. Now, it must be that he had to be cross-examined. Absolute failure could be no worse than silence, though it was very evident that along expected lines, questions relating to his direct evidence would be worse than useless. So counsel was well aware of the doctor's reputed fertility of resource and quickly decided upon his tactics. My first questions emphasized to the jury the fact that the witness had been the medical expert for the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad for 35 years, and that he had been the chief medical witness for the New Haven and Hartford Railroad, in addition to the New York Central Railroad for 40 years, and the New York and Harlem River Railroad for 20 years, and the Erie Railroad for 15 years. And so on and on, until the doctor was forced to admit that he was so much in court as a witness in defense of these various railroads, and was so occupied with their affairs that he had but comparatively little time to devote to his reading and his private practice. So let me pause here and make an editorial comment. Counsel here had looked into this expert witness's history, probably through discovery. He discovered that he was an expert witness for four railroads, that he had been for 35, 40, 45 years an expert witness for these railroads. In fact, he was in court so often testifying in medical cases against people who had brought actions against these railroads that he had very little time for his private practice. Now remember, this guy said, "I've attended this woman 300 times in 3 years. That's once every 3 days." Now, what's that tell us, boys and girls? That's right. That tells us that this doctor is probably lying about the number of times that he visited this patient. But why? Why is he lying? Well, because he's an expert witness. He's a paid professional liar. His job is to win this case for the client. After all, this woman has hired this lawyer. This lawyer has hired the expert witness. This expert witness is a partisan for his side in this case. So, very quietly, I asked Dr. Rainey, "Are you able to give us, doctor, the name of any medical authority that agrees with you when you say that this particular group of symptoms existing in this case points to one disease and one disease only?" The doctor responded, "Oh yes, Dr. Erickson agrees with me." "Counsel, could you tell us, please, who is Dr. Erickson?" So the doctor, with a very patronizing smile, said, "Well, Mr. Wellman, Erickson was probably one of the most famous surgeons that England has ever produced." There was a little titter of laughter in the audience at the expense of my ignorance. So I asked him the next question. "Could you tell us, Dr. Rainey, what book has this doctor written?" So Dr. Rainey, still smiling, said, "He has written a book called Erickson on the Spine, which is altogether the best known work on the subject." Another titter of laughter among the audience, and it grew a little louder this time. "Counsel, well, when was this book published, doctor?" "10 years ago. "Counsel, well, how is it that a man whose time is so much occupied, as you have told us that yours is, has leisure enough to look up medical authorities to see if they agree with him?" Now, the doctor was fairly beaming by this time. And he said, "Well, Mr. Wellman, to tell you the truth, I have often heard of you, and I half suspected that you would ask me just some such foolish question. So this morning after my breakfast, and before starting for court, I took down from my library my copy of Erickson's book, and I found that he agreed entirely with my diagnosis in this case." By now, there was loud laughter at the expense of my ignorance, in which the jury joined in to the laughter. Now, I asked, as I reached under the table, I took up my own copy of Erickson on the Spine, and I walked deliberately up to the witness on the witness stand, handed him my copy, and said, "Won't you be good enough, Dr. Rainey, to point out to me where Dr. Erickson adopts your view of this case?" Now, Dr. Rainey appeared to be very uncomfortable and embarrassed by this question. And he responded, "Oh, I can't do it now. It's a very thick book." To which I said, still holding the book out to the witness, "But you forget, doctor, that thinking that I might ask you just such a foolish question, you examined your volume of Erickson this very morning, right after breakfast, and before coming into court here today." Now the doctor, becoming even more embarrassed and still refusing to take the book, said, "I have not time to do it now." Counsel: "Time? Why, Dr. Rainey, why, there's all the time in the world." The doctor: "No answer." Counsel and witness eye each other closely. So I sat down, still eyeing the witness. And I said, "I'm sure that the court will allow me to suspend my examination until you shall have had time to turn to the place that you read this very morning in that book and can reread it now aloud to the jury." Doctor: "No answer." Now the courtroom was in deathly silence for fully 3 minutes. Let me pause right here. This is called what, boys and girls? The high point of the examination. Now this doctor has said, "I examined this woman 300 times in 3 years. Even though over the last 40 or 45 years, I've spent all my time in court testifying for railroads. He said, "This very morning, I took down from my copy of Erickson on the Spine where he agrees with me completely. And now when he's challenged, now when he is demanded, when it is asked of him to show, where in that book did you read that statement? He can't do it." And this is the way you expose a manifest fraud. It's just one of 23 ways that you might use to demonstrate this, but this is called the demonstration. You call upon the witness to demonstrate that which he has testified to. Out of his own mouth, he said, "This very morning, I read it. I was expecting that you might ask me some such foolish question." Okay. If you were expecting me to ask you this foolish question, let me ask you the foolish question. Show me. Where does it say that? Now, many times students sitting here in the classroom will say to me, "But how did Francis Wellman know to go to that particular book?" Well, he had to have some kind of a clue. It was probably on discovery that this Dr. Rainey had testified in discovery at some prior date that Erickson on the Spine. And so he went out and got a copy. Now remember that the city has their experts. Their doctors have examined this woman. Their conclusion was, and there were several of them, there's nothing wrong with her. This woman's hysterical. This woman has got, she's a hypochondriac. Or she's a manifest fraud and she's trying to screw the city out of $50,000. So Wellman's sitting there saying, "Well, in the event that I cross-examine, how am I going to trip this guy up? I sure as hell can't take him on in his own territory. And here's a cardinal rule that we all follow here in law. We never take a witness on in his own expertise. If I had an electrician on the witness stand, I would never take him on the issues of electrical connections and hookups or electricity. I'm going to take him on some collateral matter." Now notice that that's what F. Lee Bailey did to Mark Furman. He took him on a collateral matter. That's what we saw here yesterday or day before when we looked at Charles Fuller versus Lazarus back in 1918. We take him on a collateral matter. We don't take him on head on. We take him on an issue where he has lied, and we're going to expose that lie. And then we come along and we say, you know, the issue isn't whether or not he's read this book. This Dr. Rainey, probably if he'd have said, I don't have any other doctor that can verify my findings, but, you know, I've been in this business a lot of years, and most people, when I tell them that they've got cancer, believe me when I tell them they've got cancer. And when I tell somebody he's got a heart attack, well, and most people believe me, they got a heart attack. It's my experience. I'm a paid professional. I'm a doctor. I can diagnose heart attack. I can diagnose cancer, and I can diagnose spinal trauma. This woman's got spinal trauma. Now, this Dr. Rainey was evidently well thought of. He was an expert of experts in his day and age. We have them today. The FBI oftentimes will come out of the forensic laboratory in Washington, D.C. with a finding. But when we check that finding, when we actually check the ballistics, and there's been many, many cases of this where the FBI comes out and they say, this bullet was fired out of that gun. We take that gun out to a separate ballistics examiner and have him test it, and he comes back and says, well, here's my findings, and my findings are, I couldn't tell if that bullet was fired out of that gun or not. The barrel was too well worn. It might have been fired out of there, but that bullet that they've got there, they took out of the corpse, doesn't prove it. Now, most people accept the findings that come out of the FBI laboratory, but they're in error oftentimes, and there are many people in prison today based upon those errors. And those are called scandals. And it's not just once or twice. It's literally hundreds of times that the FBI and other police agencies have been found to phony up the evidence. Now, whether they did it on purpose or not is another story. But many, many FBI agents have gotten on the witness stand and testified against a defendant over there, and the evidence that he was testifying to was a lie. It wasn't true. And the man's convicted and goes to prison. And maybe he was guilty, and maybe he deserved to go to prison. I'm not taking up that issue at all. I'm just telling you is that he might have been guilty, but he wasn't guilty of that crime. And oftentimes policemen, when they see that you've got a rapist over here, and maybe this rapist deserves to be killed, maybe this rapist deserves to be locked up for the rest of his life, but for whatever reason, he's out on the streets, and now the policeman has an opportunity to send him away for life. And he avails himself of the opportunity by lying about him. And I say that curbstone court should be abolished. That the courts are the proper repository for our rights. It's the proper repository for deciding what we're going to do with these criminals. And if you don't like it, then go to your legislature and have them change the law. The judge will follow the law as the legislature directs. But I don't think that Dr. Rainey should come in here and lie and say, why, I just read it this morning, why Dr. Erickson agrees with me. Dr. Erickson, had he examined that patient, might have agreed with Dr. Rainey. But Dr. Erickson didn't examine that patient. And Dr. Rainey said, I read it in Erickson's book. But he didn't read it in Erickson's book. He lied about that. Maybe he did examine this woman, but he did not examine her 300 times, and he lied about that. So he lied about the examinations. He lied about Erickson's book. Could he also be lying about the injury that she received? Yes, she did receive an injury. And yes, she is entitled to some kind of compensation. But is she entitled to $50,000 or $5,000? Should the taxpayers of New York be obliged to pay this woman a disability income for the rest of her life because she fell down in a pothole? Or are the citizens of New York obligated to pay this woman for her broken leg or her broken ankle or her damage or her inconvenience and her pain and suffering, but not to the tune of 10 times more than she was actually damaged? Don't you think? I mean, just put yourself in the same position and ask yourself this question. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Let's assume that you damage somebody. Your neighbor comes over for dinner. He's walking up your walk. He slips and falls down and breaks his leg. And you rush out and you say, Tom, I'm so sorry that you fell down and broke your leg. And Tom says, well, Bob, it's all your fault. You should have shoveled the snow off of your walk in the ice and you didn't do that. And so Bob sues you for $5 million. And you say, well, Tom, look, I don't deny that I should have shoveled the snow and the ice off of my walk. And I'm sorry as hell that you fell down and broke your leg. And you should be compensated for your leg. And I want to pay you for your leg and for your time off of work. And maybe that's $5,000. But Bob, it's not $5 million. Now, do you want the jury to come back and say, no, pay him $5 million. Let's put him on total disability for the rest of his life. I mean, after all, he had an accident. This is his opportunity to score and to score big. And besides that, you've got insurance. Should the insurance company pay for these manifest frauds? You know, if you analyze it in that light and you come to a conclusion, you find that the courtroom was deathly silent for 3 full minutes. The witness couldn't say anything. Counsel for the plaintiff didn't dare to say anything, and counsel for the city didn't want to say anything. He saw that he had caught the witness in a manifest lie, and that the doctor's whole testimony was discredited with the jury unless he could open to the paragraph referred to, which counsel knew full well did not exist in the whole book that Erickson wrote. So at the expiration of a few minutes, Mr. Justice Barrett, who was presiding at the trial, turned quietly to the witness, and he asked him if he desired to answer the question. And upon his reply that he did not intend to answer it any further than he had already done, he was excused from the witness stand amidst almost breathless silence in the courtroom. Breathless silence. So he passed from the witness chair to his seat. And then he stopped and he whispered into my ear. He said, you are the biggest, the most impertinent man that I've ever met. What a fitting end to a paid professional liar. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. Hey, we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.